The SparkFile podcast contains profanity and other adult content.
And this episode also includes discussion of sexual violence. Take care when listening.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile. SparkFile. To be something that I want to make or how I want to be. Pump it in my SparkFile. SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile. SparkFile. Let's open up the SparkFile.
Welcome to the SparkFile, where we believe that everyone is creative, but smart creative people don't go it alone.
I am Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell, and we are creativity coaches who help people fear less, create more, and bring their creative visions to life.
Hey, if you're an OG member of the SparkFile community, welcome back, Sparkler.
If you're joining us for the first time, welcome, new friend.
Know that just by listening to this podcast, you are joining a warm and wonderful clan of creatives.
But hold up. You may be asking yourself, what exactly is a SparkFile?
A SparkFile is a place where you consistently collect all of your inspirations and fascinations.
If you're like us and you're making stuff all the time, or you want to be making stuff all the time, you know that if you're not careful, your campfire of creativity can flicker out.
It can, but don't despair. We're collecting kindling in the form of fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark creativity and pique curiosity.
To light a fire under our collective asses to make things like this podcast.
Or a story of seduction from an unlikely source.
Okay.
Every episode, we're going to reach into our spark files and exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who truly spark us as well.
That means we have more sparks than we can possibly use in this lifetime.
So if something lights you up, we encourage you to take that thing and make something out of it.
Without further ado, let's open up the spark file.
Sus!
Hi, Laura Camion.
Good afternoon. It's recording day.
Happy spark, miss. Happy spark day.
Happy spark day.
Good spark day to you and yours. You know what? I do love a spark recording day. I love a spark. You're going to give me a spark. I'm going to get a spark. And then I'm going to share a spark with you. And it just, you know what it is, Laura Camion?
What is it, Susie?
While I love spending time with you, it also is an opportunity to rock the entire spark cycle. I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before, but like we get a little spark of inspiration about the spark story we're going to do, and then we actually have to fan the flames and research it and write it and know our mind about it. And then we get to share it with each other and then ultimately the world. It's lovely.
It's lovely. It's the full cycle. And I personally love like the research and the committing our thoughts to paper before the sharing, because, you know, a lot of these things would just be fleeting ideas that never come back again if I didn't do that.
Totally.
And this sort of solidifies it in me brain.
In me brain.
In me brain, Suze.
Now today,
yeah,
you're sparking me.
I'm sparking you. Yeah. And I am going to jump in with a little bit, some dark feelings today, just so you know. That's what's going on over here.
I can take it.
Okay. I know you can. The past few weeks, the news has been covering some pretty disturbing displays of anti-Semitism. This particular bout of public anti-Semitism began with Kanye West, and I really don't want to give him or his ideas any more airtime. But I will just say that I was very present to the current expressions of anti-Jewish sentiment in our culture.
Yeah.
And while that was very top of mind for me, I came upon this article in the New York Times by Alexis Soloski.
Oh, love her. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Titled, How a Pro-Nazi Camp on Long Island Inspired a New Play.
Oh, my God.
Right? You know, you know, I was going to be like, what? That sentence is so loaded.
I was so curious where you were headed because I know Alexis as sort of a theater and an arts writer. And I was like,
how's this going to merge?
How's this going to tie in? But yeah. here we go.
Same. So when I saw that article, I was like, what the heck? And so I was in. And the moment, when I tell you the moment, Susan, that I read about the new play by Bess Wohl called Camp Siegfried, I bought a ticket. I mean, I could not buy a ticket fast enough.
Wow.
It was like, read. Okay. Tell me where. Immediately.
You know, Laura Camion, you will act. When someone mentions a book or a film or a play or a thing that they recommend, I have never seen somebody not only reach for their Spark file faster, but also just grab their credit card. You will not miss it.
I'm getting that book. I'm seeing that play.
If something is not to be missed, Laura Camion will not miss it.
I mean, I don't know if I would go that far because there's plenty of not to be missed things that I've missed, but things that move a needle inside my brain in that moment, I'm like, I'm on it.
Love it.
Now there's other things like culturally that people are like, oh, like everyone's raving about this or that. And I'm like, oh, okay, I might see that, but it didn't, like it didn't create a little firestorm in my brain.
That makes sense.
But this sure did. So I booked a ticket for the very next night, which happened to be their first preview.
Oh my gosh.
I literally was like, and how soon can I see this? So I had no idea whether this was going to be a great play or not, but I knew that I was drawn in by the subject matter and by the spark that led Bess Wohl to write this play. So both the subject matter and the spark like really got to me. So I was like, I got to see what the end result of this is. In this interview she gave in the New York Times, she talked about what sparked her to write it and her creative process, why the story was important, all of those things. And I sensed that like, there might be 1,000 ways to write about this material. And I needed to know what her genius creative mind had done with this information.
I love this.
You know what I mean? I'm just like, I gotta see the end result.
You know what I just already say, what I love about the spark is that I like it when we get to do sparks about the spark.
Yes.
Of inspiration and how an artist followed it. So I'm so here for this.
Yes. And what can be done with it and just hopefully remind people again and again, same source of inspiration can result in 1,000 different outcomes.
Love it.
And I think that this is a great example of that. So before I get to the play, let me tell you first about Camp Siegfried. Oh. Have you ever heard of it, Suze?
No.
Me neither.
Is this a modern day thing?
No.
Oh.
No. No. Thankfully.
Oh my God.
This is a camp that existed in the past.
The news and what's happening in the world and in our country is so batshit right now.
That's right.
Yeah. That I was just bracing for impact because it's.
Yeah.
You and I have talked as recently as yesterday. First of all, I think it's also amazing that you were able to go to a play and not tell me about it because we talk all the time.
We share calendars. So on my calendar, there's like a block. It was like Wednesday night. There's a block and it's like, I forget what I put there. Something. I might have put second stage ? Or something like that, but I didn't put anything definitive.
It's so funny because I share calendars with you. I share calendars, Hunter Bell, I share a calendar with, just so that we know, we just know where we are in the world. You know, somebody's looking in a good way. And when I see stuff like that, I'm like, oh, somebody's up to something.
Somebody is sparking something.
Oh, but what I was going to say is we have spoken as recently as yesterday about my sister was kind enough to get me a subscription to a magazine called The Week, which is essentially an aggregate of a lot of other journalistic sources. And it sort of presents points of view from all different newspapers and magazines, et cetera. And just reading that, my defenses are a little down because I've been a little under the weather, but I was shook. Like, I felt so disheartened by all of the insanity that's happening in the world. So I was fully prepared for you to tell me that Camp Siegfried is just finished its summer season.
Yeah. There's a number of things that are to be disbelieved about this. One, that it ever happened on U.S. soil, which we'll talk about. But also that, yeah, now we're sort of like, would I be completely shocked if I heard about this again? Probably not. And that's a real problem.
Uh-huh.
So let me tell you about what it was, and we will commit to making sure it never happens again. But here it is. Camp Siegfried was located, Suze, 60 miles from Manhattan, just 60 miles from here on Long Island. It's like a little bit further than the midpoint of Long Island, I'd say.
Was there a town or a...
Yeah, it's a little hamlet called Yaphank, New York.
Okay.
Yaphank.
Heard of it. Yep.
There was even a dedicated stop on the Long Island Railroad called the Siegfried Special.
Oh,
the Siegfried Special that took you directly to this camp. It was alive and well in the 1930s. It was operated by the German-American Bund and was devoted to promoting a favorable view of Nazi Germany. They had a social club for adults year-round, including activities and events like Oktoberfest. In fact, in 1938... Sorry, war is going on. We're not, the U.S. is not in it yet. But in 1938, they hosted German Day and 40,000 people attended, many of them taking that train in from Manhattan. In the summer, they hosted summer camps for teenagers, and they had all the activities. They hiked, they swam, they danced, they learned archery.
Yeah, that's how they get you.
Yeah, that's how they get that.
Yeah.
But the whole time, they're being immersed in Nazi ideology. In the United States. And by the way, Camp Siegfried was not the only one. There were others in Wisconsin, in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania.
Of course there were.
Now, in that New York Times article I mentioned, Arnie Bernstein, the author of a book about the German-American Bund, said that on the surface, it was like any other camp, except that it was filled with swastikas. And when you see the images, Susan, like, I'm talking about shrubbery shaped like swastikas, flags, all of everywhere.
Can I pause you one second?
Yeah.
The word bund is,
weird.
It's not a word that's familiar to me, but that's a German word that means something, I'm guessing.
Yeah, let's look it up.
Let's look it up together.
What does bund mean? Bund, actually.
Bund. Bund.
A pro-Nazi German-American organization of the 1930s. Oh, here it is.
Federation.
It's an association.
Yeah. Got it.
Especially a political one.
Okay, great.
A friends, bund. Thanks for hanging with us.
We learned something today. A bund.
Okay. So on the surface, this camp looked like any other summer camp, except that it was filled with swastikas.
Yeah.
And you might arrive there to like men in the black shirts and the women in sort of German, traditional German garb. But that is not all. I read further on the Washington Post. The purpose of Camp Siegfried was to, quote, raise the future leaders of America and make sure they were steeped in Nazi ideals. These future Aryan leaders, Susan, were not only forced to physically build the camp's infrastructure so that they could avoid hiring union labor because they believed unions were full of Jews.
Okay.
So they used the kids to sort of build the whole thing.
Okay.
But they were also coerced into having sex with each other in order to breed a new generation of perfect Aryan children.
Okay. So what you said earlier about this dark subject matter is indeed, it's darker than I thought.
And according to a 2016 article in the Daily News, they didn't just encourage sex between the kids. They also forced it.
Oh, God.
And afterwards, like with camp counselors, et cetera, afterwards, there were horrific accounts of like male counselors raping the female campers.
Oh, my God. So it's not just like you know, when we think about like summer camp and summer camp movies like Meatballs or Wet Hot American Summer, it's, you know, like a bunch of horn dog teenagers.
Yeah.
This is horrific.
But I think it had that aspect as well, because, but it was like, but with permission. You know, when I think of those camps, there's still a little like naughtiness about like sneaking away for your first kiss or more than your first kiss. But in this case, it was like condoned and encouraged that the kids would sneak off together and procreate.
Yeah, but sexual assault.
Yeah, exactly. So that was one part of it. But then if that wasn't happening, the male counselors, it sounds like, got to have their way.
Oh my God. You know, like how do you, I'm assuming that this isn't advertised in the camp brochure. Otherwise, like how, as a parent, do you send your kids, your daughters? Like,
actually, I don't know the answer to that from research, but I don't want to give too much away about the play. I'll talk about it in a minute. But in the play, you know, the parents were, like I said, there was an adult component to Camp Siegfried. So they were members of this society. And in the play, at least, and I trust that she did her research, but in the play, there was an aspect of like, someone might be pregnant and their parents are going to be thrilled.
Okay.
So I think there actually was more awareness than we would like to imagine.
Okay.
All in the pursuit of their ultimate goal.
Yeah.
So in better news, the camp was seized and shut down by the U.S. government when Germany declared war on the United States in 1941. So it had been protected by the First Amendment, but once we were at war, it became illegal for American citizens to swear allegiance to Germany. Mm. Like, you can't actually swear allegiance to the country that we're at war with.
Right.
So at that point, the town erased it from memory, like wiped it out. There are little historical centers in that town that don't mention it. Now, this was a little bit of information that I thought was interesting. There's some evidence that the indoctrination worked on people. According to that same Daily News article, in June 1942, a German U-boat quietly landed off the shore of Long Island near Amagansett Beach. Four men, three of whom were former Camp Siegfrieders. They paddled ashore. They had a stash of explosives and cash. Apparently, they buried their Nazi uniforms in the sand along with their explosives. They were planning to sabotage the war effort by blowing up military installations. Luckily, a single man, they ran into a man who was a member of the Coast Guard who spotted them, and they attempted to pay him off. He took the money, but then he went to his superiors anyway and immediately let them know. One of those men confessed, getting the three others arrested, along with another group who had landed in Florida with the same intentions.
Wow.
So they were in deep. It succeeded in really making some passionate Nazi followers and people who became Nazis.
Wow.
And fought against America.
So, wow.
Anyhow, the way that Bess Wold found out about the camp was during the pandemic. She and her husband booked an Airbnb on Long Island in Bellport.
Okay.
And apparently she Googled things in the, to do like in the area. And so Google spit out some information. She stumbled upon a website that mentioned this camp. And then she, of course, just went down a rabbit hole, kind of like I did.
Hot spark.
Finding like photos of the camp, even archival film. And so she hopped in her car to get a closer look. She drove through the area that used to be the camp.
Wow.
And the surrounding village.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. She discovered the streets, Seuss. The streets in this little American village had been named after Hitler, Goring, and other like high-ranking Nazis. The street names have been changed at this point.
Okay.
But she also discovered that in order to purchase a home in this area, you had to prove that you had German ancestry.
Interesting.
After the camp had been shut down, it became what they called a planned community called German Gardens. that was in place. This restrictive housing covenant that you had to be German in order to buy a home here, that was in place until 2017.
Oh my God.
That's right. 2017.
And would we say that, or do we know if those people were just German people, or was it like a little Nazi enclave?
Don't know.
That is
yeah.
Weird and dark.
It is.
Hitler Street. Oh my God.
Hitler Street. Yeah.
Okay.
So in that same New York Times article, Alexis Solosky describes also driving in the area more recently. And seeing, along with these announcements that this is a private community, this is that German gardens area, there's no swastikas anymore. But although, Susan, some of those homes were built with like swastikas in the brickwork.
Oh my God.
Right? Oh my God.
Long Island.
But now, no swastikas, but American flags and Trump flags fly in the neighborhood. So I read that for the play Camp Siegfried, which is, as I mentioned before, at Second Stage, and it's there until early December at least, Wohl approached the play, get this, she approached the play like a story of seduction. When I read that, I was like, huh? Like a just real disconnect at first. But the kind that makes you like lean in, not lean out. I was so intrigued. Like I would imagine, like my mind would immediately jump to like, this could be a story of defiance or repulsion or coercion or redemption, like any number of things that come to mind, but seduction, I'm super curious. For conspiracy theories or ideologies where someone or a group of people are othered and blamed, you know, for the world's problems or for your unhappiness. And eventually large groups of people get on board with violence and harming those who are different from them. That happens over time.
Yeah.
Right? We don't just jump on board with something like that. People get slowly seduced by the idea. So I was like, oh, maybe this is a story of seduction. So, like I said, I was completely and totally sparked at this point, like by the subject matter, the fact that this camp existed in the US and so close to us. And I was sparked by the way that she discovered this camp, how she researched it. And then I was sparked by what she decided to do with it. I mean, I haven't even seen the show yet. I was completely lit up. So I started writing the spark before I went to the show. But 24 hours later, I was in my seat at the Second Stage about to see Camp Siegfried. And I asked my friend Laura to join me. Hi, Laura Coward.
Hi, Laura Coward.
When she got there, I was delighted to find out that she didn't know anything about the show. Like she hadn't read that article yet, which was perfect. So we agreed that I would not say a single thing about any of the background. We just watch and see how it hits each of us, given what we knew about the backstory. And so let me just say up top, I'm not going to review the show in detail here. I don't want to review it. I want to talk about what Bess Wohl created out of the spark that she felt.
Yes.
So regardless of how anybody reacts to it, I am dazzled by what she made out of the information she had. The show's a two-hander. Both the leads were making their New York stage debut, Johnny Berthold and Lily McInerney. They were both incredible. The set design is its own character. And the more you know about Camp Siegfried, the more you can appreciate everything about that and everything you see. I'm going to avoid spoilers.
Oh my gosh, I'm intrigued.
I know. And I just want to say, people, if you're able to see this show, I think you should see this show. So Bess Wohl took this information that I just shared with you about a teenage summer camp for pro-Nazis in the United States. I'm sure she took more information than I just shared with you, but she wrote a coming of age first love story, and she did it beautifully, like expertly. What the actual F? Seriously, I'm just like, How'd you get from here to here? Mm-hmm. But like I said, upon closer investigation, it does start to make sense. When I think about teenage summer camp, I think about the thrilling possibilities it always promised. Maybe first kisses, maybe first love and intense feelings that you're absolutely sure will never change. You might have the opportunity to try on new roles at summer camp, like be a new person. Maybe your friends back home treated you like you were powerless. But at camp, you have the chance to take on a more emboldened persona, a powerful persona. Or maybe your family treats you as though they have very low expectations of you. At camp, you might find a way to show what you are capable of. Turn the tides for yourself. And over the course of your summer, maybe you push the limits. Maybe what was a first kiss leads to first intercourse. Maybe your first lesson in archery leads you to your first hunt, killing your first animal, taking your first life.
You know, it's so funny because just knowing what we know about what this play is about, if you didn't know that, if you're Laura Coward and you sit down to watch this, it may spark a certain sort of like warm or wistful feeling. But knowing what we know about the greater context, this is like a horror movie.
It is. And she slowly reveals, like throughout the play, you do like get context clues of like, oh, okay, we're in the United States. This character's from Baltimore. Interesting. Okay. Oh, they're saying their parents are over there. And you're like kind of piecing together what is happening and what are we actually talking about, is what I fucking love.
Yeah.
Excuse my language. So perhaps at summer camp, you gain like awards and accolades that leave you emboldened to sort of march confidently out into the world, feeling like a new person, perhaps like a more powerful person. Not all of the things I just described happen in this show, I should say, but the script is really a masterful exercise in using one thing to talk all about another thing.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So the entire time we're watching these two form a relationship at summer camp, in retrospect, we're really talking about the slow seduction of ideology. It's baby steps. It's the introduction of ideas. It's the justification, the escalation. As Beth Wohl said, it's a play about seduction by bodies, by beliefs, by stories. In the end, I'm just going to share one thing, just one line from the play. I so don't want to spoil it for anyone, but if you're going to see it, pause now, I guess, and come back to this. But our heroine, in the end, experiences a traumatic event. She tells us how she wandered out of the camp and found a doctor. She's physically okay, but she talks with a doctor about everything she's been through. And he says, anyone can fall into anything, really. Anyone can be seduced. And then he says, never underestimate our infinite capacity for delusion. That hurt. That hurt so much. And it just like resonated and stayed with me just thinking about what is happening in our country. Families being torn apart by political beliefs, by conspiracy theories, by propaganda. It's on my mind all the time, honestly.
Yeah.
Anyone can fall into anything, really. It just made me shudder. I was reminded of this article by a writer named Mick West in a publication called Big Think. And the article was titled, "We Are All Conspiracy Theorists." And Mick writes about how there's such a wide spectrum of people who believe in conspiracy theories because the spectrum of conspiracy theories itself is very wide. There's a conspiracy theory for everyone, basically. Mm-hmm. And he says very few people are immune. Mick West's belief is that everyone has a demarcation line. So on one side of the line, there's science and reasonable theories they feel are probably correct. And on the other side of the line, there's non-science, gibberish, propaganda, lies, disinformation. So to help illustrate this point, he created this scale on which various conspiracy theories are ranked based on their extremeness. So It would start, for example, like maybe like the idea of big pharma trying to sell drugs yeah. that people don't need in order to make more money. This would yeah. be like the lowest thing on the scale.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, it's kind of, maybe you're sort of like, that's a reasonable idea because they are about profits and selling drugs we don't need would make them more profitable. So I could maybe get on board with that. That's lowest on the scale. And then on the other end of the spectrum, and this is going to sound like I'm joking, but I'm not joking. On the other end of the spectrum is for real a belief that a cabal of shape-shifting trans-dimensional beings is running our government. And that's most extreme. But there are people, QAnon theorists believe that that's what's happening. So you have this spectrum and everyone, he believes, has a line in the sand. So wherever your line is, he says, you are likely to believe everything leading up to that line, but nothing beyond that line. Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
So for me, like my demarcation line might be around one or two. Like I'm willing to believe that potentially there were other people besides Lee Harvey Oswald involved in Kennedy's assassination, which is it's a conspiracy theory, frankly, because we don't have any evidence of that. But I'm like, you know, if someone presented some evidence of that, I wouldn't be totally shocked. So maybe I'm somewhere around this, like one or two, but I'm not signing up for chemtrails, which is probably like a seven or eight. I'm not signing up for like some a flat earther. I'm not like all of that is well beyond my demarcation line. But for someone else, like if you do believe in some of the more extreme theories like the reptile overlords.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Or if you do believe that the earth is flat, you are likely to believe every other less extreme theory as well.
Yeah. Got it.
The point of all of that is that none of us are immune. We're not immune. In fact, having some prudent paranoia is useful to the survival of our species. So we don't want to lose that bit of paranoia that's like, yeah, maybe the government does do some of these things, or yeah, maybe there is some evil force working. But we want to avoid, I think his point is, and maybe Bess Wohl's point is, we want to avoid thinking that we are above all conspiracy theories. Mm. Like it would never happen to us. Mm-hmm. I would never believe that because I think she's right. We can all be seduced by anything under the right circumstances.
Laura.
Yeah.
I'm thinking right now, and I don't want to out anybody, so I'm going to say this thoughtfully, but I'm thinking about right now about somebody who I used to work with really close colleague, somebody who I really adore, and their grandfather as a kid was, you know, this sort of hungry, poor kid mm-hmm. and went to Nazi summer camp essentially and was fed, like had food, had, you know, shelter, had nature and fun and training. And it's sort of like under the right circumstance. That's a more extreme example, but you can see how I always think about that, how there's so much shame for people who have that in their lineage and in their past.
Well, it's, you know, this is too big to crack open right now, but the similarities that we're seeing with certain things happening in our culture now as well, like when you can find a population of people that is disenfranchised, feels cut off from help and support, feels isolated, like there's a number of factors that play into it. Psychologically, it is easier to seduce them than other people who feel like I'm doing fine or the world is a fair place. Or maybe the world isn't fair, but the fact that it isn't fair is true for all of us. And so there's a weird fairness about that. Mm. Like if you have that sort of belief system as opposed to look what's being done to me, it's easier, I think, to convince those people that there is someone to blame for that. And then you can identify, and throughout history, not just right now, and not just with Nazis, but throughout history, immigrants, no matter where you live. So if you're in Germany and people are entering Germany that are not German, immigrants, or in the US, immigrants, they're often the easiest group to blame
right.
for our problems, even if there isn't actual data that's proving they affected your life in a negative way. It doesn't matter. It's like someone providing you with like, look, you, there's a seduction to like, there is someone you can blame for this.
Mm.
There is a group of people that you can focus all of your negative emotion, frustration, anger at. And there are people who will take advantage of that.
It also makes me think about, I'm fascinated by that graph that you described.
Yeah.
If you fall to this extreme on this graph, then you'll probably like scoop up and believe the things that, you know,
all the other things
to this point. There's what I thought you were talking about, and I don't think you are, but something that I sort of became fascinated with in 2021 is this thing called the conspiracy chart, which looks not like sort of a dyad, just a line, like a timeline.
Yeah.
It's a triangle. Does that ring a bell?
No.
Somebody put a lot of work into this conspiracy chart. And essentially the triangle, the smallest part of the triangle is down towards, pointed towards what we'll call the ground. And the widest part of the triangle, so it's sort of balanced on its nose.
Oh, yeah.
And so down at the bottom, we have sort of things that actually happened.
Yes.
And then up at the top, we get into the, like the red hot, like detached from reality.
Yes. This is exactly what I'm talking about. This is like, you're sort of, you see here, you're like, I don't know, one third of the way up and you're like, we're beginning to leave reality now. But but the original, you can see how it happens. These original things that were quote unquote conspiracy theories were then proven to happen. So that's like a gateway. You're like, well, Watergate did happen. The government did lie about this. Operation Paperclip did happen. Tuskegee Airmen were tested on and lied about and by our government. So you sort of are like, this is an entry point to start believing things.
Yeah.
And then you start leaving reality. This is amazing.
Whoever made this, I have this in my Spark file, and this is what I first thought you were talking about. But this is a really cool infographic because it's interactive and you can click on any of the conspiracies to learn more about them. And some of them are, I'm going to say, relatively harmless, like Elvis is alive kind of thing. Or some of them are funny, like Ted Cruz is actually the Zodiac Killer. And then some of them get into what the builder of this infographic calls, you pass through the anti-Semitic point of no return, which is where it gets, you know, not only is it unhinged, it's dangerous.
Yes. And it's dangerous because when, especially when you look at any of this and you realize that people are being whipped into a frenzy that leads to violence or a willingness to perpetuate violence based on these ideas. And they are systematically training people to dehumanize other groups of people. And that's how you get to genocide. Like, how the hell does that happen? It's by slowly
seduction,
being seduced into the idea that these aren't real people anyway. These are aliens. There was a longstanding belief that the queen was one of these reptilian aliens. And what is this? Like, Biden is a robot, et cetera. So if you can literally separate them from their humanity, you have a more willing
army.
Yes. To inflict harm.
Wow.
Or, and the step before this, before, I think it's a step before they are actually reptilian aliens, is they're pedophiles.
Mm.
We can all agree there's just, you know, nothing worse than people who would harm children in that way, and mass murderers and pedophiles. So you, again, you make it, if you can convince people that our politicians are pedophiles, you can arrive at the breaking into Nancy Pelosi's home, looking for her, wanting to murder her, and instead beating up her husband.
Yeah.
Suze, I get really fired up about this.
I get really disheartened by it. It really, it scares me and it freaks me out and it depresses me.
Same, but I was working on another Spark and came upon some information that might be useful to help. It might be helpful.
I'll take it.
Okay. I discovered that it feels like conspiracy theories are on the rise now. It feels that way because of social media and the quickness with which we can, you know, get news out. But in actuality, conspiracy theories have been around since the 1400s. They usually raise their, like, oh, there's more awareness around them during times of like instability.
Huh.
And so you can actually track through time that these things are, they happen every so often. Now, obviously, there's times where, like Salem witch trials, the Nazis, and others and others and others, where it leads to huge groups of people being persecuted,
killed. Yeah.
And that's where I think like it gets like super scary. And I think that's why we're scared now of like this might all lead to violence. But the reason they don't go away is because of profit. It's follow the money. There's money to be made off of flat earthers. There's money to be made off of election deniers.
Alex
There's
Jones.
Money to be made,
There's money
right?
to be made, yes.
I don't know. I guess I take a little bit of solace in knowing that we just have a greater awareness of it, but they're not necessarily growing in power or growing in numbers of people. I hope that's true. I hope that remains true. And, but I'm totally with you on the genuine concern for violence and where this leads.
Absolutely. Because if you have people believing the big lie that the election was rigged or the election was stolen, and then the people that believe that and take that position are in roles of authority,
yeah,
in politics, in the actual election, then it starts getting really dangerous.
It really does. And like, not to be a voting answers everything person, but if the numbers are true that more people don't believe in this stuff than do believe in it, if we
all
freaking vote.
If you take nothing away from this podcast today, I just want to say, let's just say it every episode. Vote. You have to vote.
You have to vote.
The options are, we thought like, oh yeah, you know, you might've been a person who was sort of like, I haven't voted yet in an election. If you are of legal voting age and you haven't been voting or haven't voted recently or ever, it's time to vote. It is time to vote.
It's time to vote. And I'm also going to say it is time. We're getting a little into what do we make of all this, but it is time to pay attention to what's happening in your local education boards.
Yes.
And because as evidenced, even in this Spark, the battleground is for young minds.
Yes.
Because they want to indoctrinate them from the beginning. And so pay attention to what is happening and get involved on the local level, because all of that will make a difference. This summer camp that we know of, there were people who literally tried to thwart the American effort in the war, and they came right from this camp. So it works on malleable young minds. So we must stay diligent.
I agree with that. I just want to jump back for a second and just, you just said that conspiracy theories have been around since the 1400s. I'm guessing have been documented since the 1400s. And I'm just curious what a 1400s conspiracy theory might look like or sound like.
You know, Suze, so number one, I bet there's conspiracies about the plague, just like we have with COVID.
Uh-huh. Like the, what is the source of the plague?
That's right.
What is the cure for the plague? Yes,
and
absolutely.
I think that what we saw were spiritual and witchery. So like when things would have magical thinking, basically. So when something might happen, someone got sick, right? And two nights earlier, they had dinner with this person. So making false connections between things and making it sort of witchery and religion they were occupied with.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I think so.
I don't love it, but it does make sense.
So what do we make of all of this, friends? What we just mentioned, number one, stay diligent. I hope that we can take an awareness that we are all capable of being seduced. From pickup artists to propagandists, there are groups of people who would benefit from us believing things, in particular, believing things that divide us. Mm-hmm. So stay focused on using your superpowers for good, my friends. Stay focused on what heals us, the art forms that bring us together. Let's stay diligent and focused on that. Mm. As creatives, I hope we are all so sparked by Beth's approach to this story, making her play a story of seduction. When I think about all of the historic stories out there, and you know I love them, Suze. I love to write them. I love to read them. I love to watch them.
You would marry them if you could.
I would marry my historical stories, but I think that this is an essential step. One way of writing the story is exactly as it happened chronologically. That is a fine choice. Like, tell us what happened. But another way to approach an event in history or a person in history you want to write about is to determine what kind of story it wants to be. Sometimes we can have the very same information, and one creative might say, I see a story of redemption. And another might say, I see a love story or a story of forgiveness, and on and on. And with a person, you can sometimes just take like a person who's had a really big life, like Elvis, or, you know, we've seen these biopics. You can take just one section of their life, and like this decade of their life was a story of forgiveness. It doesn't tell the whole story of their life, but this part of it tells this story. It's a worthy endeavor to take the time to explore this before jumping into the retelling of a historic event.
I love that you say that, because just to bring you into our world a little bit, recently in our Blaze course, Laura, you did a kick-ass class. You did this curriculum around storytelling. And while it centered more on storytelling and screenwriting, it really spoke to so many of the different creatives in the group, including me. I don't consider myself a screenwriter, but earlier when you were talking about Bess Wahl framing this as a story of seduction, I was like, ah, Laura, story themes. Like how,
yes,
if you do make something out of this, like how you frame the story and what themes you want to use to, I don't know, make it relevant and human. I love that.
And heal people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks, Suze.
Yeah.
I know you know this, Suze, but I want to end on this thought. I know you know my grandfather was a Screaming Eagle in World War II.
I do.
He was a paratrooper in the 101st Airborne. He jumped out of a plane over Normandy Beach on D-Day. He wouldn't talk about what he went through during that war, but as a family, we've pieced a lot of that together. And I might do like a full spark on that one day. But for today, suffice to say, I grew up knowing one thing. The Nazis were our enemy. And no matter what else people disagreed about, we could all agree on that. We could draw the line at religious persecution and mass genocide, full stop. I grew up with that understanding.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of what Bess Wahl said in the New York Times. If we're going to live up to the moral imperative of never again, we have to look at these stories. We have to tell these stories, and we have to learn from them.
Agreed.
That's my spark.
It's a good spark, Laura. It's a hard spark.
It's a hard spark.
It's hard, but we can take it. Why? Because we're strong creative conduits.
We're strong creative conduits. And sometimes it is about finding the way in which someone can receive information as well.
Yes, that's great. What do we make of it too? It's a weird tension to be like, you and I think are both super sensitive people. And we also believe deeply that we're strong creative conduits. It's a weird tension.
It is.
But I think it's both can be true.
Like I can hold this. Hold all of this and understand that it is all for good. It's storytelling for good and for healing and for love, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. What it's all about.
Clap, clap. Great spark, Laura Camion.
Thanks,
Ace. Oh, boy. Woo-hoo. That's it. This episode of The Spark File was made on the lands of the Lenape people. And as always, we hope that this put another bunch of sparks in your file. Listen, if there's a spark that you'd like us to explore, or if you'd like to learn more about how to coach with us to bring your creative ideas to life, email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com or submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
We will even happily take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you got to share a creative risk that you have taken recently.
You can follow us on social at The Spark File and be sure to subscribe, rate, and 5-star review this podcast. It really helps other listeners to find us. Also, if you like this podcast, we hope you'll share it with people that you love. And if you didn't like it, I can't imagine why you didn't like it. What is not to like? It's awesome. Little Baby Cams is awesome.
Oh, thanks, Suze. If something did light you up, or get your creative sparks flying, we are writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that has been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take that spark and fan it into a flame.
You know, you got to take it
and
make it. Bye.
Bye.
Vote.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark file. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my spark file. I jump into my spark file. Let's open up the spark file.